Cottonwoods, New Hampshire, delegates from 44 allied and associate countries arrived for the opening of the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. To be discussed are plans for the stabilization of world currencies.
The Bretton Woods Conference in 1944 created, among other things, the International Monetary Fund. At the time, US Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau claimed Bretton Woods marked the end of economic nationalism. But is his vision and the institution of the IMF itself still relevant in 2018? Welcome to a special edition of Vox Talks, a series of conversations with leading economists around the world. My name's Tim Phillips. 20 years ago, following the Asian financial crisis, many questioned whether the IMF was able to create the stabilization that Bretton Woods had promised. The four authors of the CEPR's first Geneva report called for the IMF to embrace change. They warned that it must become more efficient, more independent and accountable, and more transparent, both to governments and to the general public. Now, for the 20th Geneva Report, the same four authors have taken another look at the IMF's structure and governance to find out what's been achieved in the two decades since their warning, what's changed in the global economy, and the new challenges that the IMF faces. Today we're going to be speaking with all four authors to find out why they have concluded that IMF reform is, in the report's title, an unfinished agenda. Later you'll hear from José de Gregorio of the University of Chile, Takatoshi Ito of Columbia University, and Charles Wiplos of the Graduate Institute Geneva. But first I asked Barry Eichengreen of the University of California, Berkeley, about what has changed in the last 20 years and the challenges that these changes present to the way the IMF works. He told me that the continuing increase in international capital flows mean that problems that the IMF was created to solve aren't going away.
Volatility, contagion, sudden stops in capital flows are very much a problem still today. And we have seen this recently in the cases of Argentina, Turkey, and I think more generally across emerging markets. So there has been a bit of retrenchment in capital flows since the global financial crisis, but that's mainly less interbank lending. Overall, capital flows have continued to expand over the last couple of decades, and with them, capital flow volatility.
In 2018, a report says that the world is more financially integrated, but that the financial liberalization that the IMF and others predicted at the time of your first report doesn't seem to have happened.
I do think that there has been continuing movement in the direction of financial liberalization and integration, but not as uniform, not as complete as some people forecast 20 years ago. For example, there has been tightening of capital and regulatory and lending and liquidity standards for banks in the wake of the global financial crisis. And there has been a reluctance on the part of certain countries like China to go all the way in the direction of capital account liberalization. So China did begin down that road after 2009 with its renminbi internationalization push, but it ran into a severe bout of financial volatility in 2015, including financial or capital flight, and it tightened up on cross-border flows. So I think the movement continues, but it's partial and uneven.
Instead of this financial liberalization, we've seen the accumulation of financial reserves, the emergence of permanent bilateral agreements and regional funds. Is this a case of countries finding ways to avoid doing business with the IMF?
To a considerable extent, I think the regional arrangements that we see, like the Chiang Mai initiative multilateralization in Asia, is a response to dissatisfaction with the IMF. So if you look back at the history, the Chiang Mai Agreement came in 2000-2001 in the immediate aftermath of the Asian financial crisis, when Asian countries concluded that they had been dealt with harshly, unfairly by the IMF, and when they began to grow despondent over the prospects for more meaningful IMF reform. So yes, I think self-insurance by accumulating reserves, swap agreements, and regional agreements are all responses to this feeling of unease about governance and operation of the IMF.
But the IMF has not stood still during this time, both as a response to criticism and to the changes in the global economy. José de Gregorio points out that it has now less emphasis on current accounts, has improved its surveillance, and is less dogmatic about capital account liberalization.
The Fund has taken a broader view of macroeconomic imbalances, and these are real benefits for the Fund and for the constituency, because it has a more pragmatic view regarding macroeconomic imbalances and policies, and recognizing that one size does not fit all. The current account imbalance are still a concern, but in particular regarding its financing, since we have witnessed a very large volatility of capital inflows, so this has created and has induced crisis and turmoil around the world, so, and especially in emerging markets. So now we have to have a view on capital flows movement is quite important from the point of view of the IMF. And this has also led them to be much more pragmatic regarding capital account liberalization. Its benefits depend on how strong are the domestic financial system and how balance sheets of the private and the public sector will react to financial turmoil. Again, I think that all of this has been a quite positive progress in the IMF view of the world economy that has changed so much in the last 20 years.
So how has the IMF updated its tests for sustainability?
I think that this is a very important and difficult and controversial issue. Now the IMF routinely uses this debt sustainability analysis in Article 4 consultations. It also revises the framework from time to time, and it has a lot of documentation and research. This is always controversial. The Fund focuses on 5 years horizon, and this could be extended to the long run. And there is a need for more discussion because you cannot tighten mechanically the sustainability 5 years, one outcome. There are a lot of outcomes, and we need to evaluate the effects of many and different paths for fiscal deficit and for fiscal variables.
Nevertheless, an important problem is that the demands on the IMF in terms of lending have continued to grow. Can it secure adequate resources in the future?
The Fund has expanded its resources. They have more than tripled, but as a share of global GDP, they have gone from, in the early 2000s, from 1.1% of global GDP to 1.8%. Now, the increasing capital flows has been much greater during this period. So the Fund needs more resources, in particular, if crisis hit many countries at the same time. Some ad hoc arrangements on a country-by-country basis, like extending the swap agreements to a multilateral basis, all of this may help. As of now, as long as crises do not spread around to too many countries, the amount of funds may be adequate. But if they go with contagion across many countries and many countries that have strong fundamentals, this may be a problem.
For a long time now, the IMF has provided precautionary credit lines for emergency funding, but these haven't been taken up. So why is that?
These credit lines have changed over time, but they have had very little success. Countries need to apply, and when they apply, there is a stigma. More recently, the Fund has estimated that these lines cannot be permanent. So at some point, countries should exit. So why they enter in the first place? So countries would like to have it, but they don't apply. We argue that the Fund should implement a fast qualification facility for countries with strong fundamentals. We already have, as a result of surveillance, an assessment of how strong the economy is. So this could be serve as a basis in case that the country wants to apply for a credit line. So we think that it is possible for economies that have strong fundamentals to be able to mitigate global financial turmoil in order also to safeguard the stability of the global economy.
At the time of the first report, the IMF's insistence on structural reforms as a condition of lending was being widely criticised. Has it moderated its position now?
There was some strong argument to say, well, let's push for reforms because in moments when there is a program, perhaps we can introduce some reforms that are difficult to implement within normal times. However, many reforms imposed by the programs were not related to the problems of the country. Second, many of these reforms were also tackling issues that in a crisis you have to be more careful. For example, eliminated subsidies when employment is going up. So in 2002, they revised their operational guidelines, recognizing that the structural conditionality is appropriate only when reforms are related to the origins of the crisis. The fund has reduced the importance of structural reforms in the programs, focusing on those strictly related to the origins of the crisis. And that makes a program much stronger in terms of legitimacy and the ability for the political system to adopt the programs.
Another area in which many people wanted the IMF to moderate its positions were on its support only for fully flexible or rigidly pegged exchange rates. Again, has that changed?
When we wrote the previous report, that was kind of the view that countries should adopt one of the two extremes. Currently, I think that it has more nuanced views. Indeed, most countries have some form of intermediate regimes. The extreme views, especially in emerging markets, are difficult to implement, are difficult to sustain. Many countries float, but from time to time, they accumulate reserves. And this is part of the macro management. The fund has been quite pragmatic again and recognizing that there is a wide variety of policies that countries can adopt without the imposition from technocratic extreme views. And I think that this has been extremely helpful during the global financial crisis to mitigate their effects.
Even if the IMF has evolved, for governments that require assistance, it's certainly not the only game in town anymore. Since the first Geneva report, the growth of regional financing agreements has been dramatic, as Charles Wiplosz explains.
Regional financial arrangements are agreements among countries of the same region that agree to help each other in case they run into financial or economic crisis. This is the role that the IMF fulfills for the whole world. But some regions have built up their own agreements to either supplement or possibly dispense with the IMF.
Can you give us a good example of these regional financing agreements today?
There are three main ones right now. There is one that has been created ages ago in South America. There is another one that China has been building up. And then there is the European Stability Mechanism, which is a full-blown, fully developed institution that in many ways mimic the IMF.
But surely there are arguments in favor of these agreements. So should we necessarily assume they're a bad thing?
The classic argument is that these are countries that are more likely to be like-minded, that have common interests because they are close neighbors, that understand better and have better knowledge of what's going on in the neighboring countries. So these are the usual arguments that are openly said. And then there is the not openly said argument, which is let's avoid having the IMF in the neighborhood. There are big problems of governance within the IMF, and that irritates a number of countries, plus the IMF has this reputation of imposing tough conditions for its loan. So regions that have had experience with the IMF have started to build up these institutions with a view of changing the balance of power of financial institutions, not within the IMF, but alongside the IMF.
Also, if RFAs mean there's less pressure on the IMF's resources, shouldn't the IMF be welcoming the help?
Right. The IMF faces a government's problem. It also faces a resources problem. Now, one argument is, say, look, these RFAs are helping out the IMF with limited resources. Of course, that's true. The problem is that the IMF was built around the idea of multilateralism and that these regional arrangements are breaking down the multilateral system as we know it. And it's fundamentally against the wishes of the founding fathers of the IMF and of the world multilateral system that we have been living with over the last 60, 70 years.
Is there a clear idea within the IMF how it should be working alongside these RFAs?
So the IMF has started to think how it can coexist and cooperate with these regional funds. Should they expand? Should more of them show up? So far, it has set up a number of principles which make a lot of sense, but are pretty general. It's nice, it's crucial to have a set of principles, but at the end of the day, there is a serious issue of disagreement between the IMF and the regional fund with which it may operate. And that happens, of course, at the worst moment in the crisis. That happens when there is a tremendous political upheaval in the country. So there is a need to think through how we do it next time.
Do we have evidence that the overlapping mandates of RFAs and the IMF can cause problems in the real world?
Both step in and both analyze the situation and both come up with a diagnosis and medication, but they can disagree all along. And let me give you a very clear example, which I think is the reason why we had the crisis in the euro area. When Greece went in crisis in early 2010, it had a very large public debt. And given the many limitations of the country, the cleanest and cheapest solution would have been to restructure the Greek debt. That's what the IMF proposed, and that was totally refused by the Europeans. So at the very, very beginning on what do we do next week, there was a disagreement. Now, since the Europeans were putting more money than the IMF had to play a junior role and didn't complain about lending to a country that was unlikely to pay back its debt. If the IMF had been listened, the crisis would have lasted a year or two. There might have been no contagion, and the world would look very different from what it looks like now, including politically. What do we do when we have such fundamental disagreements? Do we go by the biggest purse, which was the case with Greece, or do we try to have a way of resolving serious diagnosis disagreements?
One country in particular has a different role in the IMF now than it did in 1998. China's share in global GDP has quintupled from 3% to 15% during that time. During the 2020s, it's likely to become the world's largest economy, and by extension, the largest shareholder in the IMF. Takatoshi Ito explains that the historical domination of the IMF by Europe and the US may be about to change.
I think fundamental change is coming, and the center of global economic activities are shifting to Asia. And the Articles of Agreement of IMF states that headquarters of IMF should be in the largest shareholder country, which has been, of course, the U.S. since its founding of the IMF. So when China surpasses the U.S. in GDP size, as many predict will happen in the second half of 2020s, I think big decision has to be made. This Articles of Agreement will be honored so that the headquarters will move to China. That will be a really fundamental change. I think in Asia in general, including China, Japan, Korea, and Southeast Asian countries, increasing their weights and voices, so gradually this change will take place. But I have to caution that Asia is not one force or one group. China, Japan, Korea, and Southeast Asia have some political tension and disagreements. So this movement to Asia is not like movement to EU or Eurozone, which is more coherent and homogeneous. To repeat, yes, the fundamental change is coming, but in which way, not certain at this point.
Do you think the Chinese government is committed to Bretton Woods-style multilateralism, or do you think there's going to be a renewed focus on narrower institutions like the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank or the New Development Bank?
Well, so far, China has been a responsible member of the IMF, and the growing influence of China in the IMF has been, so far, very positive. So I do not see any problem at this point if China becomes the largest shareholder. But as we know that China maintains a different political regime from the Western political regimes, China has so far maintained capital controls much more than the Western countries and Japan. So their economic policy and leadership maybe slightly or maybe greatly different from the West. And if Chinese start to insist on that, that will open up significant conflicts. On the development finance side, China has already created, as you mentioned, the AIIB and the New Development Bank, and they have the vision of this One Belt, One Road initiative, which has already showing some conflict and problems. So I think we are seeing the early stage of Chinese vision. And whether China will move towards more traditional ways or they try to continue to be their own way will be tested in this development finance arena first. Then we will see how China may behave in IMF, global financial leadership.
Are we going to see different policy messages coming from the IMF in future? For example, about the role of government in promoting growth or capital account liberalization?
Yeah, with respect to capital controls or capital account liberalization, we have already seen significant change in IMF policies. And this is not because of China, but because of the Asian countries as a group. So this is more like lessons from the Asian currency crisis of 1997-98, which China was not part of it. But the ASEAN countries and Korea and Japan was behind those reforms that changed the Asian safety net and Asian ways of financial development. So I think IMF finally took notice of this and changed fundamentally the policies of capital account liberalization. Now, China has slightly different views of the role of the government in various aspects, from industrial policy to financial development to other more political area. I would say it's more shades of gray that we can observe even among the Western countries. I do not think it's going to be a clear-cut conflict on the role of the government in economic activities. Those philosophies, thinking are changing all the time, and sometimes crisis makes those thinking to change. And China will be part of this process.
As Chinese influence grows in the IMF, how's the US going to react?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And honestly, I do not have the answer. I think it's up to Washington and American people how they want to play the leadership role. Under the Trump administration, seems to me that U.S. policies is going more tilted towards closing off the markets and pushing Europe and Japan away from the U.S. leadership. Whether it's intended or not, I think that will benefit the Chinese leadership role in the world.
Whatever the external challenges for the IMF, a major part of its unfinished business is to improve the way the fund is organised. The report sends out strong criticism of the IMF's governance. Barry Eichengreen again.
We focus on IMF governance in the report because we think that power relations are important as factors shaping what the IMF does and doesn't do. We think that governance of the fund, such as it is, doesn't reflect the realities of the world economy in the 21st century, where U.S. voting power in the fund is still more than 5 times the share of China. So we argue that the IMF will both be able to make better decisions and implement better policies and be regarded as more legitimate and accountable by member countries if those governance problems are effectively addressed.
You advocate structuring the IMF more like a central bank. So what would change if it did this?
If the management team of the IMF had independence of a modern central bank monetary policy committee, they could take decisions that were in the global interest rather than in the interest of the principal shareholders, which the fund, I think, has done too frequently in the past. The management team could take a long-term view on what constituted good policy, and it could make credible commitments without fear of those commitments being overturned or overridden. by powerful national shareholders. A case we look at in detail is the 2010 IMF program for Greece, when the fund agreed to a plan that did not involve restructuring the Greek government's debt. It agreed to that plan because of arm twisting by powerful European shareholder governments that feared the consequences of a Greek debt restructuring for their own banking systems, an independent management team that was insulated from those political pressures could have pressed harder for debt restructuring, and the result would have been better policies, a better outcome not only for Greece, but I think for the world as a whole.
Surely there's a problem with this, though. A central bank's got a clear mandate, it's got tools how to achieve it, and the IMF doesn't really have that.
One reason why central bank independence is viable is that it's easy to judge the success of central bank policies. Is the central bank hitting its inflation target, and therefore to hold the independent central bankers accountable for their actions? The IMF is a more complicated institution with multiple objectives and multiple instruments, as you said. We argue, however, in the report that the reality is that modern central banking as well is more complicated than the textbooks would have it. Modern central banks engage in a whole range of different policies. They worry not only about price stability, but about financial stability. Central banks like the Fed have dual mandates where they worry about growth and high employment. They utilize a variety of different instruments, not only interest rates, but prudential policies, balance sheet policies. So we don't think that the variety of different targets and instruments that the IMF has to worry about necessarily disqualifies the fund from pursuing this model of independence.
If the IMF's governance and accountability aren't reformed, do you think we could see a permanent retreat from the multilateral idealism of Bretton Woods?
I worry greatly about that possibility of a retreat. I think we see evidence of it underway already in the network of central bank swaps that the People's Bank of China is building. So strengthening the legitimacy and the accountability of the IMF, I think, is important for the survival of a rules-based international monetary and financial system. I think given the global environment we're in at the moment, including the impact of the Trump administration's policies, this goal of strengthening the IMF through governance reform is more important than ever. I think that everything in terms of global economic and financial architecture is up in the air at the moment because the current U.S. administration is not obviously sympathetic to, how should I put it politely, promoting a larger role for multilateral institutions. China and Europe in particular will need to step up to defend and strengthen that architecture, and we'll have to see whether they're able and willing to do that.
A reminder that the 20th Geneva Report is called IMF Reform, the Unfinished Agenda, and you can find that on the CEPR website. This has been a Vox Talk from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. If you're a binge listener, you can now find all our new Vox Talks, as well as some of our most popular episodes from the last 10 years, on all the major podcasting platforms, as well as at voxeu.org/vox-talks.